Hello and welcome to a Without Reform Rabbit Trails Conversation. I'm Joel Meyer. I will be joined today by Robert, and then Brian Cooper stops by halfway through the episode. We start with the conversation with Robert and I around the priest class and money and how we view pastors as being put back in a position between us and God. And we revisit our conversation about Moses and the mountain from episode one. Sound quality in the back half is not going to be as good as Brian and I are passing a microphone back and forth. Do not hate us for that. But ultimately, what this show really is just a couple of buddies having a conversation. So we hope that still shines through. We have a frank conversation about language in this one, so there are some swear words that are not edited out. If you have young ears or that offends you, just a heads up.
So this is the middle of a conversation we're having.
Yes, Robert. Keep going, bud.
The problem I have with the anarchist burn it down approach to church or writ large is that humans need some kind of structure, some kind of system. So we can tear down systems that don't work, I think, only if we have an idea of what to replace it with. Otherwise, we get something more akin to the Reign of Terror, French Revolution. Like, they just were like, we're done with the monarchy. And then, like, nature, society abhors the vacuum as well as nature. So something's going to step in. And it's a decent chance, if you don't have a good proposal, that what fills that vacuum is worse than what used to be there.
Yes. So what am I proposing fills it? I'm proposing going back to the Garden of Eden notion, which is, how do we know right from wrong? Well, it's not from our heritage. It's not from something that comes from us that we have built. It's what God tells us is good. And so the portion here is not structure's bad. It's questioning, is what we have actually from God, or is what we have something we have built and it's from ourselves and it's a Tower of Babel moment?
And then I think the question is, at what point does something become a Tower of Babel? Like, because it's not bad. Man-made structures and systems are not in and of themselves bad.
Right.
But uniting, they can become.
Uniting
that
is good. So what was their point for the Tower of Babel? It was to become God.
Yeah.
They wanted to reach heaven on their own. And I think there's a decent amount of overlap with our church structure and that notion.
Totally. Like, the idea that, like, we can, and I think this is what democracy is about sometimes, is like, we are trying to develop a more perfect system so that we have less of a need for grace or whatever. And I was actually kind of processing this a little bit this morning. Like, we do need to be established in something. Otherwise, the winds and waves of hardship that we all face is going to, like, throw us off. And that happens to society too. So how do we establish a system that only goes so far, but not too far, in order to replace God, or, like, move into the place of God for us?
Well, this is part of the problem with the Enlightenment, because I think we now have this perception that we can reason our way into that.
Yeah, man.
That is exactly the garden situation. How do we know if we can do it? Well, we know right from wrong. We can figure this out. So are we just creating an entire complex, that field we talked about last time, where God doesn't have to have anything to do with it except for what the boundaries are?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think that's somewhat accurate, but I think there's a Venn diagram where what is on the other side of that? What's the other circle that overlaps? Is it our efforts, or is it our freedom to make choices? Is it, you know, I don't know what we want to label that as, but I think it has a pretty big impact as far as how we do label it and what that brings us towards and into.
Well, be a little more specific about that, because I think I like where you're going, but I didn't totally understand it.
Yeah, so it's sort of two things can be true at the same time. And I think there's overlap. But the one thing we know for sure that is true is the notion of the garden is that, does it matter if we know right from wrong? Not really, because God is going to teach us and show us what he wants us to do in any situation.
Hmm.
But what's also true is sort of that notion of the New Testament being sort of like, well, do these things, but, like, there's not a lot of specifics within those other than, hey, if you can do it, do it. So within that notion, what is our responsibility? What is our choice? But then the flip side of that is, what is us trying to reach God on our own efforts? Does that make any sense, or do I need to?
I think so. clarifying question. Are you talking particularly about human morality or decision making in general?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, and that's where the structure thing comes in. Is structure a moral force? Not necessarily. It can be, but it does not have to be. The way we have built the modern church is where our structure is only a moral force because it creates a B.F. Skinner type level of behavior modification that pushes people to act a certain way so we know if they're in the club or not. But that is not the way it has to be. And I'm not even sure that that's what's supposed to be on the other side of that Venn diagram.
Well, yeah. So be a little more specific about that Venn diagram then. I think that's maybe where I wasn't sure where to land.
Yeah, well, and that I don't know either. This is sort of a burgeoning thought. We know the one side has to be that God will tell us what to do.
Okay.
On the other side within that structure, if we're talking about, hey, he's going to give us the edges. Now within that, we get to do whatever we want. This is sort of where you get into the Arminianist and Calvinist views of God is going to predestine us to do everything, or he's going to give us free choice, or, you know,
okay.
In what we have built, are we building the golden calf or are we taking care of the garden?
Sure. So where the Venn diagram overlap should be is like a place of trust. Is that right?
Well, yeah, reliance, right? I mean, that is the whole concept of abiding in Christ. If you wanted to get into Hudson Taylor's Spiritual Secret or John 15, yeah. Walking in the Light, some of the things we talked about last time. Man, this is a good episode on money in the church so far, huh?
tangents before even we get to the original idea, like we're outdoing ourselves.
This is us. This is quintessential us. So yeah, I guess I don't really know what belongs on the other side of that Venn diagram that overlaps in the right spot.
Maybe
that's the ontology of church.
Sure. Maybe what I'm hearing you say is like on the one side is like this is what God has told us what to do. And on the other side is like, this is what we can figure out or have freedom to do.
Yep.
And like, so there are some things that God doesn't really say anything about that's outside of it. And like, so like, it doesn't really matter if my house is made of wood or brick.
Right.
And then there are, I don't know what would be an example of like something that God has spoken about that doesn't overlap with our freedom. Like, is that circle completely contained? Like, what would be non-overlapping from that section?
I don't know. Do we get into a weird tangent that's going to take us into a rabbit trail that we don't want to come back from? Do we want to stop here and
maybe this
and think
is,
about
yeah,
this?
I don't know. Maybe we
come back
we
to it or
this and put it in a different episode.
That notion of two things being true at the same time, though, is sort of very helpful for the money and the priest class that I wanted to talk about and how those two intertwine.
So
maybe as we go through that Venn diagram, because those both have a Venn diagram that are inclusive to themselves, but I think also overlap with each other.
Okay. So why don't you lead us into how two things being true at the same time and draw us a Venn diagram that relates to this money priest class question.
So I'll start with money, sort of like you talked about last time with the Judas question. Hey, you should remember, you should give that money to the poor. Well, Judas didn't really care about the poor. He was pilfering the money box, right? That's why he said that.
I would dispute, but continue.
I mean, that's literally in the narrative, so you're going to have a hard time with that, but it's okay.
No, I wouldn't disagree, but I would dispute because yes, I know, like he was stealing money and he didn't totally care about the poor, but I think the appeal is nonetheless, Jesus responds to it as if it were sincere.
Correct.
He doesn't say, Judas, you are full of shit.
You grimy little grubby.
He says, you'll always have the poor. You won't always have me. This is a beautiful thing that was done to me. The response is still validating. Well, we shouldn't just think of the money in terms of like a socialist equity, which is maybe I'm taking that too far. But I sort of wonder if that's where the disciples are going in that moment or generally when it's like, well, we've got some things that are expensive. We need to distribute that so that there's a little bit fairer coverage for the poor. And I'm not anti-socialist. You know that. But
sure.
But anyway, I mean, like I'm already tangenting off of your intro. So why don't you finish up what you were trying to say?
Well, so I think the one side of the Venn diagram is what you laid out last time, which is remember the poor, but God likes extravagant things for himself. So how do we keep that intention as sell everything you have? But then that didn't work out for some of the churches, right? They had to get money from Jerusalem to fund their churches because no one had anything left, because they maybe devoted mm-hmm. themselves a little too much to remembering the poor, that they became the poor. And the temple was extravagant, and Jesus was okay with nice things, and on the other side of that, right? So how are we holding those in tension? What's the overlap there where it's good?
Man, I can't tell if you're frozen.
I'm not. You just started saying something, so I was going to give you space.
No, my comment was just like that, man, that's complicated. And I think it's complicated by the fact that Americans are such individualists about their money that it's hard to look at it either in terms of how do we use it for the poor or how do we use it to glorify God. It's a lot easier to look at it in terms of like, well, how much do I save? How much do I spend on myself? How much do I give? If we can categorize it like that, well, then that kind of eliminates the heart questions, which I think are maybe essential to processing this.
Well, and this is why focus on the tithe is a little bit of a hindrance to this point, because we're just trying to get people to move towards a percentage. We're not trying to get people to listen and acknowledge the spirit in real time. And that's probably a good move into the priest class thing, which is God tells us to be teachers and apostles and preachers and those things. But what we have turned that into is, hey, we're going to stand between you and the cross and bring you in front of God. But it's not in front of God, it's in front of Jesus. And the very thing that we were supposed to utilize to come into contact with the Father, the Holy Spirit, we basically neglect completely, where it was better if the Spirit left. It was better for Jesus to leave so that the Spirit could come than for Jesus to stay with us. And yet our entire time, we just look to Jesus. I will often say, I don't know that I believe in the Trinity. And it's more so that I don't know that we believe in the Trinity as a culture, and we don't understand what it would mean if it was actually true.
Sure. I thought we were going to talk about money in the priest class. You want to talk about the Trinity? We've got a whole couple episodes to back up there.
We got to be fair, we'll have a lot of time, hopefully, on this whole adventure we're going on. Yeah, I mean, we got to rush into anything.
But man, the Trinity is a...
You froze. Frozen.
Can you not even hear me?
I can now. All I heard was, man, the Trinity is a... Now I can hear you.
Oh, it's a fun topic. Oh. Would love to dive in.
Okay.
But ruins the recording, but you get to test your editing skills.
They're not good. I apologize to anyone listening to these episodes. They're not, my editing skills are not good.
But back to the priest class and the mediating kind of thing. Like, again, I think this is a question of like, how far? Because it is not bad to have leaders who are devoting themselves to the teaching and preaching of the word. At what point do we cross a line from teaching the word to mediating relationship with God? And I think that was one of the things that the Reformation pushed against, maybe not initially, but eventually, of like the rejection of confession as if confession were a mediating of God's forgiveness, which I don't think it necessarily is. Tangent for another time. But anyway, like it is easy to get to that point of mediation. Is it a question of pride?
Boy, I mean, it could be. And again, this is one of those things where it's a heart thing. And that's where the tension is, because I've known good pastors that have devoted themselves to the teaching of the people and really care to seek God. And I have known people that call themselves pastors that are not, and play at it and stand in the way between people and God. And how do you know the difference? I think by the fruit. But these two questions combined, I think the money and have pastors replace themselves in a new priest class, are interesting, because they can, you can do the right thing for the wrong reason, and you can do the wrong thing for the right reason on both of these. And I think the overlap for what the heart looks like is pretty large. For what it should look like, But again, this is one of those situations where how is this such a hard question to answer what it should look like? Does that mean we failed, that we don't have a rubric, a metric, a heuristic, whatever you want to call it, to even be able to look at the situation and go, oh, that's bad? Just go, no, that's the position they hold. It's fine. They have the authority. They've been put there by God, obviously. What are we aiming for? And how do we know if it's right or wrong? Well, the tithe, 10%. Oh, this person went to seminary. Oh, we don't believe in seminary where we are. We just believe in lifting people up that God has raised. Well, how do you know if God's raised them? They agree with everything we say.
Right. I often think that it's helpful to look at history. And this may be another case where I don't know what the lesson from history is, but you are making me think of the progression journey that monasticism went on. And like when monasticism started, it was all about renouncing the world and vows of poverty and chastity and whatever. And within a couple centuries, as the popularity of that burst, like monasticism became about wealth and land ownership and power and all these, like the mission completely shifted. And I think it's like when there is something good, people are drawn to it. And when people are drawn to something, that those people are not necessarily pure hearted. And yeah, so you get things that are become twisted. So
does
Does
absolute power corrupt absolutely, or people that want absolute power already corrupted?
And
like, is there something wrong or broken with someone that needs the attention and the power that comes from a point of authority with being in front of everyone and talking about it? Like Jesus said, if you want to be the leader, you have to be a servant.
Yeah.
You have to be dirty and forgotten. And yet all of our power structures put people that want to be seen and get the attention and the affirmation that comes with the position.
So with that example and observation of narcissistic exploitation of positions in church, I think you might be able to track the trajectory of American evangelicalism similar to the track of medieval monasticism, of like, you started with something good. I think American evangelicalism, what was good and what drew people was like genuine life change for anyone who came. Like the Great Awakening had its issues, but it brought new life to people who hadn't heard it before on a wider scale than had happened before, and was possible in America because of the frontier. There are all these untouched places or people with European roots, but really religiously, socially isolated in some ways.
Yep.
Where you couldn't really do it in Europe easily because you'd be building on hundreds of years of established religion. Anyway, that was the good thing that drew people to it. And then you got the narcissistic people coming in to fill those places. And now we're seeing the corruption that happened to monasticism generations after it started. And then what happened to monasticism is it just kind of crumbled because it became so corrupt. You maybe had a few monasteries that continued that were particularly good, but then they crumbled when corruption took over. I wonder if that's the trajectory of American evangelicalism, because we've had a pretty strong spate of narcissistic, exploitative leaders that have corrupted basically the institution, at least in the eyes of many.
This is such a great monologue for why we should burn it all down. It's not even your opinion. Thank you.
If I'm right, we don't have to burn it down because it's going to burn itself down.
Well, yeah, that's not a bad point. So why do I think we should be proactive instead of reactionary?
Well, hold on. What, can I give one other clarification too?
Yep.
I'm specifically talking about American evangelicalism. I'm not talking about the American church. That is not, I think like mainline Protestantism is not experiencing the same like wide scale, high reaching corruption. I'm not saying there's not issues there, but I think the issues in American evangelicalism are on a different level. That means that American church is going to look a lot different after evangelicalism burns itself out.
Okay.
Hey, you know, I'm coming in hot. I haven't done any research. I'm not like, these aren't.
No. I would see it almost backwards from you. So I would like to dive in a little more why you see there being such a broad line between Protestantism and evangelicalism.
Well, no, mainline Protestantism. So like the Lutherans, the Methodists, the Presbyterians versus the non-denoms. And maybe
so are you just talking straight corruption, or are you talking degradation of core truths?
I'm talking like what seems to be the core issue in American evangelicalism to corollary monasticism is this kind of narcissistic, power hungry, wealth seeking strain in leadership.
Sure.
That it's not that it doesn't exist in mainline Protestantism. It's just so much less common that it's not their main problem is different.
Yeah, well, and I would say the main reason for that is that they have a rigid position for the priest class built into their liturgy, whereas evangelicalism does not.
Huh, that's an interesting spin on it.
Do you disagree?
No, I don't know if that's like I'd have to think about if that's the primary distinction. I think it's a fascinating one.
That's pretty off the cuff, but I think it's not. I don't know that it's right, but I don't think that it's far off. Let's put it that
right.
way.
I mean, particularly among Lutherans, where I think the priest class is like well established. You're right. I mean, like even in the like Presbyterian and Methodist churches I've been in, there is an appreciation for that minister, that pastor, that is like a respect or an honor for that position that is different than you see in the non-denoms or the charismatic spectrum. So that could very much have something to do with it. I don't know. I'm tempted to think too that just like the lack of historical roots in American evangelicalism, like everybody thinks that they're the first people to get New Testament Christianity correct. Basically since the first century, that might be part of it too.
Yeah. I mean, we revolt against history in such a distinct way every single time that it's the exact same pattern.
That's America, right?
Yeah. There is no distinctness left because it's just the same path over and over, but we think we're trailblazing. And that that is the frontier, right? Oh my gosh, this is a wild land. No one's ever been here before. What are we doing? Oh, look, Native Americans that have been here the whole time. Like, you know. How wild of a land is it really if people are already there?
But that's interesting.
And have survived for centuries.
Evangelicalism as like an imagined spiritual frontier of like people think, and I think this is American culture, like we are frontier seeking people. And it just so happens that there's an ocean on the other side and you can't get any further, but you have to keep pressing into some kind of frontier. And you pretend that what was there before isn't there, and you build something new. And you can't really do that in the physical world as easily as you can in the, I don't know, ideological, theological in this case.
Yeah.
So like, yeah, just pretend like we don't know anything about Augustine. We don't know anything about the roots in Western Christianity or the roots in Eastern Christianity.
Right.
Let's just start the heck over and just read the Bible and we can figure it out.
Yeah. I mean, that is sort of my point in a lot of this too, is that if I can have friends that I know have had no contact with each other and have no overlap in their church background, how can I predict exactly what their response is going to be to certain stimuli? And I know where that thought came from. I know the thinker it was, but these people have no idea. They just know that it's the talking point they need to regurgitate.
Yeah.
And so kind of going back to the concept of we need to be able to have that hypothesis on the table, since we no longer know the thinkers it's attached to or know how it's progressed through history. That's part of my burn it down thing too. Like, you can't use thinkers as your reasoning for thing if you don't know how they got there.
Maybe, but I think like what you're also making a kind of counter argument to burn it down, because if we're talking about historical roots, if anything, we're pruning the unhealthy branch. So, and you're smiling and nodding like I hit it.
yep.
Like we don't want to burn it down to the ground, but we want to burn it down to where it's not bearing fruit anymore and get back to the fruit bearing parts, right?
Which very well may be the ground. Like, are we willing to admit that all the way down to the foundation is where we need to go with this thing?
Well, so what is the foundation to you then?
I want to say squirrel, but I'll say Jesus Christ. I mean, I think this is again why our gospel is broken, because what is the beginning of everything we're trying to fix? Sin. No, it's not. What are we trying to fix? That we were once in communion with God and we lost it. How do we get back to communion with God? Okay, sin's keeping us from that. Great. Good answer. But ultimately, even if we fix the sin problem, often our response is just, well, try not to. And it's not that lordship. It's not the discipleship. It's not the other parts of it that what are we trying? What is the ontology of church? What are we trying to get back to? I think we are trying to recreate the Garden of Eden.
So I think when I hear you say the foundation is Jesus, I mean, obviously, yes. But I think the question that comes up where we might differ is, how far back do we have to go to reach the place where Jesus is?
Yeah. And I don't know that answer. I'm just saying, are we willing to say, oh, we've been wrong this entire time? And I don't know that we have been. I think my guess is there's a point where we had it right for a little bit. You know, are we willing to look at the New Testament the way we look at the Old and go, hey, maybe Paul was saying some stuff that's out of line? Maybe
do we do that Peter with the Old Testament? Do we do that with the Old Testament?
No, we should though. But like,
whoa.
Was David perfect? Was Moses perfect? Was
now
Joshua perfect? Right? Like, okay. We will recognize their faults. But somehow when we talk about the church leaders, even though we know Paul had to defy Peter to his face, we sort of have this attitude that like, oh, they could do no wrong. What did they do? Oh my God, that's amazing. That's exactly what God wanted them to do. Instead of reading critically and going, oh, maybe that was pride and that's why they said that.
Yeah. I mean, once again, and maybe we'll mention this a lot more, so much of this is of the problems we have are a failure of critical thinking. I mean, like even I learned a helpful distinction in reading different genres in the Bible, narrative versus normative.
Yeah.
So helpful in being able to like say, just because this story happened doesn't mean that it is the example that we should follow. Jacob, right, having a dozen children with four different women doesn't validate polygamy. And so similarly, but we don't apply the same standard to the book of Acts, I think, right, which is narrative. Anyway, that's another tangent. So I don't know where we were going before that. I'm sorry, the rabbit trail. I can't trace it back.
Who knows? Who knows? I think it has to do with the foundation and how far are we willing to burn it down, and what do we view as foundational?
And so, like, if I'm going to continue using the tree analogy and like pruning the unhealthy branch, I think it's a question even of like what, maybe that analogy doesn't work, because what is the tree? The tree isn't just Jesus, but if the tree is the church and Jesus is in it, there are going to be a lot more fruitful branches that we are tempted to judge, then we're likely to see them as not fruitful in the way we think they should be. Like I'm thinking, say, the Nestorian church, Eastern Christianity that lasted from like very early, like the Armenian church in the 300s lasted until the 1400s, into like persecution and murder and rampage and whatever, like basically wiped them out.
Huguenots.
Nestorian. What?
Well, the Huguenots, the, you know.
Oh, no, no, that's way different.
I know. I'm just saying other things that have popped up and disappeared through time.
Sure. Like what one of the reasons I bring these guys up is Nestorianism is branded a heresy. Like there is a creed that says, if you believe what these people believed, you are outside of Christianity. And yet this was the church of the East for 1,000 years.
Yeah.
And are we looking at branches that are connected to Jesus, but branding them as unfruitful or unfaithful in a way that Jesus does not.
Well, this is sort of the Norm MacDonald joke where, hey, I'm reading my history book and it says here that all the good guys won every war. Imagine that.
Yeah.
And it's like, hey, was Tesla actually a good guy? Or should we have gone with Thomas Edison as like who was the victor? Whose ideas were better? Well, we don't know because Edison won. So look at how great everything turned out because of history.
But
should he have won? No, we just look back and go, oh, this is what we have. This is normal. This is good. And so I'm sort of trying to take that same tact with theology throughout history, which is, man, was that actually the best thing that could have won? Or is it just what we're used to now because we've been defending it for 500 years?
That's valid. And I think like what I'm seeing is that like the Spirit is in almost all of these expressions of church. But I think what you're saying, which kind of can dovetail with this, is that that doesn't mean we need to keep those expressions. That if Jesus is working in multiple different varieties, then maybe there's another expression in which we can draw near to him in a way that suits us better. I don't know. Does that fit?
It can. I mean, in a way that suits us better.
I know that sounds a little human-centric, so I don't know.
Yeah, and to be fair, a lot of why I'm saying these things are, again, is it what I'm saying or is it what I'm, or am I trying to get us somewhere with being the kind of the badger that pokes and prods and makes you go somewhere else? I don't know that we need to burn everything down. What I mean, I was smirking a little bit when you were talking about, well, what is the vine even? What would it be? I mean, John 15 is literally Jesus saying like how that works out in a practical sense, but you know, it's fine.
But the reason I even asked that is because like, if the vine is all Jesus, then we shouldn't burn any of it.
Well, it's going to get pruned. I mean, within that passage, they talk about things that are going to get pruned and cast off. And, you know, so are we willing to let go of those things because they're not of God?
Sure. But then, I mean, like what we're getting to is the vine and those things that are pruned are branches on the vine. So then this whole thing, it's got to be like the body of Christ, right? Like, which is more of a metaphorical abstract. I don't even know what that is half the time.
Yeah. So this is the difficult thing about these conversations is what are we actually even talking about and what metaphors work and why do we have no idea?
Dude, I mean, like even the disciples, when Jesus said like, we're going to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man is going to be killed. They're like, what is he talking about? Like,
who could he be referring to at all?
And so I feel like even sometimes when Jesus is clear, people get confused. It's understandable for us to be confused. And I mean, maybe that's a place of prayer.
Yeah. And again, I think a post-enlightenment stance is, well, if we just talk about it enough and reason it out, we can get there. And then you have Hume in the corner saying, yeah, then you have Hume in the corner saying, well, how do you even know that that's true? How are you making that assumption? How is that reasonable? And then it's like, oh, well, now we're just on our way to postmodernism. Yay.
I love postmodernism. I have a newfound love for it. So that could be an episode. But
it's not as bad as everyone makes it out to be.
If you look at a philosophical movement as a question,
right?
Some questions lead you in helpful directions. I think postmodernism does. Because postmodernism asks, how do you know?
Yeah.
And if you are taking that question seriously, well, then you start looking for like foundations of truth. That's a good thing.
Well, and that's the question that God answered in the burning bush with Moses, yeah. Right? Hey, who, how do I know that this is who, like, what do I tell people when they're asking, how do I know? What's the answer?
Yep. And this is why I think the fundamental flaw in the Enlightenment is the Enlightenment is saying, like, you can figure this out. And, like, you are rational enough to find the answers. And that gives us far too much credit.
Right.
We need revelation, but I would say even before revelation, we need relationship. It is through relationship with God that we can receive revelation. So let's not trust our own minds as much as we trust other people.
Did God really say that you would die? You will not surely die.
Yeah. Well, snakes.
Snakes, man. Every time. But that is, I have tried more often recently to look through philosophies and questions and how we're building things through that lens of, are we asking, did God really say that? Like, you know, that's sort of the, are Christians going to be affirming to the gay community? Is premarital sex bad? Is, what should we do with our churches? It's a lot of it is, did God really say that? That's not what he meant. What he meant was this. And everyone's slicing and dicing the text to be reasons for their argument and why it's right. And we're not willing to just look at someone else and go, maybe you should just go to God with that. And I'm not going to step into your life in a way where I have to be the authority for you in that moment on things that are perhaps unclear, because I don't know right from wrong. You know what I know? I know what God has said. And I trust you and believe that he can talk to you about this, because guess what? The veil was torn and he left. You want to know why he left? So that the Spirit could come. We are either indwelled with the Spirit, and that is a real thing, or God is a liar. And what do we want to choose?
Dude, I was going to ask you to tie it back to the priest class, and then you just did. Like,
yeah, I'm going places sometimes.
Because I was thinking as you were starting, like, would it be better to have a priest class that just dictates, like, these are the answers to these questions? And yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Like, it is better to recognize a torn veil that allows us to receive the Spirit, that lets God guide us. The funny thing with that, though, and if you're talking about premarital sex, LGBT things, is people are going to hear different things from God. And we have to then be okay with a degree of chaos, or we are okay with a theological war, which I don't think we're okay with that either.
Well, so we know who we trust to have spent time with God and who we haven't. It's sort of, you know, at the end of the book of John, Jesus says to Peter, hey, you will reach out your hand and someone will lead you where you do not want to go.
Yeah.
And Peter says, well, what about him? What about John? What's going to happen to him? And Jesus goes, what does that matter to you? He has his own path. And so I think we have, for so long in the evangelical circles and in other circles, positioned ourselves where, since we know that we are following God, everyone's life has to look like ours, because otherwise they're not following God. Mm-hmm. Because the things that I wanted to do that they're saying they want to do, I wouldn't have been following God if I did those things. So they can't do them either, because I know what it's like to follow God, because I followed God.
Totally.
And there is... should there be a little chaos with God? Sure, there can be.
Well, go ahead.
Is there going to be unity because they're all in line with the Spirit? Yeah, man. Dude, the people I know that I feel like they have had a real interaction with the living God and their heart has been changed to a point where I don't understand who they are anymore apart from that. We can disagree on anything. And you want to know what? It's fine. Because I still trust them that they're following God at the end of the day, and they get to answer for that, and I don't.
I think it's the shepherd pasture thing again, of like, within this open pasture, we can go in a lot of different directions. If we start to go out of line, as long as we're continuing in relationship with Jesus, he's going to pull us back to where the real pasture is.
Right.
So in that sense, like, I can disagree with people about women pastors, for instance.
Well, that one's for sure not true. They shouldn't be pastors. Any other questions open to interpretation, but that one we can't do.
That one to me is like the least sensitive even. Like, of course people can disagree, and yet some people continue to be hardline. Anyway.
We're back. T's got to put his little earphone in.
I think
so. Do I have to talk?
Say,
coming through loud and clear.
Hey, should I call you Brian or should I call you Coop? I've heard both.
Doesn't matter. I'm not picky.
But give me one. Otherwise, I'm going to waffle between them.
I waffle.
You know, waffle. Waffle all you want. That'll make it sound like we have a more robust conversation going on.
All right. Sounds good.
For these purposes, this is Robert.
Okay.
But actually.
You can call me Rob. I've also been incorrectly called Brian on a number of occasions. So
maybe we should go with Coop then, so there's no confusion there.
Have you are you guys into Monty Python sketches?
Always look on the bright side.
I have a feeling.
Or is it the sunny side? I can't remember
this. You want to introduce yourself a little bit for the podcast sense?
what does the audience want? Like a little bio or what are we doing here?
So this is Coop. This is the gentleman who recorded the segment on Telos and that we referred to in the last episode that will either be attached somewhere along the lines. He is my main contra partner when it comes to arguments and telling me that I'm wrong. So we want to make sure we loop him in as much as possible so we know that I'm not the one that's right. Anything else you want to add?
No.
This is going so well already. Okay. So Coop is hopping in here in the middle of a conversation. We're just going to mainline it. Is talking about why he hates women pastors.
A soft intro there for you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, thanks for setting me up with the opposite of what I was saying. but I was more like backtracking to the context of that point was we're talking about the pasture and Jesus as our shepherd and how in the context of this pasture, like we can have a ton of different ideas. We're free to roam because we're not boundaried in by specific fences, but we've got a good shepherd who is looking out for us. And he's keeping together a bunch of people with a variety of different ideas, one of which is about women pastors. And I felt like that was a tangent that I didn't really need to go down.
I think it makes sense because when we're talking about the potential for theological chaos, if we're willing to just let God speak to individuals, that is one of the most contentious areas where you can find a decent amount of evidence on each side of the argument. And so are we going to label heretics on the opposite side from us, or are we going to be willing to trust that God can deal with them and change their hearts if he needs to?
We... not too long ago, we're part of a church body that split over that issue where people left because egalitarian.
Yeah.
We shifted to an egalitarian model. And I think I almost wonder if kind of to Joel's point, if it, and maybe this fits well within the overarching narrative of what we're going for too. I think part of the problem was how it was done. Rather than it being done. And it became this heavy-handed, top-down, not only are we right, we're also going to bring in a very popular theological author who is an egalitarian to come in and give a sermon right after we make this change. So that's just
gaslighting.
That became a real contentious issue. More so because of how it got done. And so people I knew and respected left, and they said that was why they left over they were complementarian. But I think at the end of the day, the reality was that was the last straw of a domineering leadership group that came in and said, if you don't do things our way, not only are we're going to put you in your place in a really demeaning kind of way.
It was explicitly narcissistic.
It's interesting.
That pastor also. Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. I think I so often put the complementarians in the domineering place. So it's interesting to hear a story of domineering egalitarianism. But I think even as. Oh, go ahead.
It was unique. Very unique. That pastor later went on to have a really, really nasty sex scandal. So.
Oh gosh.
It was just lovely all the way around.
So we didn't respect women.
Or respected them too much. I don't know which way to go with that one.
Dominatrix. All right.
But I do think like you're I don't know, getting at what is really the core. It's not when we raise right theology to a higher level. So in a small group that I'm in, we're currently going through the transcendentals, truth, beauty, and goodness. And thinking about that made me kind of realize, like, in our church society, we often obsess so much with rightness, being right about everything, that we can't be good about anything anymore. So, like, if we were able to say, like, we are seeking goodness, complementarians and egalitarians, people are seeking goodness. These are different conceptions of goodness that prevent us from having, like, Sunday morning worship service together. But God bless you for your vision of goodness. God bless you for your vision of goodness. Like that is something that can like, cause I hear a church splitting and I'm like, can people on either sides of those aisles continue in unity and love for one another? And it might be hard if the central issue was who is more right, but it's maybe not as hard if the central issue is we just want what's good.
Which is why the priest class is an interesting concept, and the fact that it, the way Sunday services are set up, is the cross is on the wall and the pastor stands between that and the congregation. I'll say it again. We are putting something in between us and God, and we have to have them filter God to us, right? It's the Israelites with Moses coming down the hill. Hey, your face is shiny. Can you cover that? We know you spoke to God, but maybe just keep it simple and dumb. Like, we don't want the whole thing. And what is that doing for our churches as it comes down to, tell me what God has said? I do not need to hear God speak. What has God said?
C.S. Lewis gets at this too, with the whole notion of the Bible is not the thing that we worship. Totally. The Bible is the thing that points us to Jesus, who we worship. Jesus is the one who tells us that he left us his spirit because he came from the Father, right? There, and this gets into your, we can get into,
he wasn't even here for that, but he just nailed what we talked about earlier. I love it.
did I miss that? I'm yeah, recovering ground.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. But no, okay. Going to Trinitarian to cover it sometime. We'll do a preview of our next episode.
I don't know if I want to go full Trinity right now, but to this point of, I think we get caught up in things that are supposed to direct us, right? It's telos. I gave that our little spiel on telos, and we get caught looking at the telescope rather than the telescopic view. And that really shortchanges things. And even to your point on what is good, I'm teaching a middle and high school group right now on cultivating wisdom. Mm. And pretty much what we're doing all year is we are asking the question, what is good? What is that? Because I know a lot of Christians who talk about don't let anything impure leave your lips as, don't say fuck. Can I say that? I'm sorry. Am I okay?
He said shit earlier. Oh, I'm fine with that.
Okay. Right.
He'll bleep it out in post.
Yeah.
I won't.
Yeah.
We're raw dogging that one.
But I know people who get really caught up in, well, that's impure talk. And it's like, no, dehumanizing people is impure talk, but there's probably a particular reason that word exists in our language, because it fits a certain time and place. We can get into my whole issues around language some other time, but I think, again, that's we get caught up in things that are not good.
Affectionately, I have been referred to as a fucker in my life. Like,
yep.
That is just what some people, like, it's the kindest thing they can say. And yet it's like, no, that's evil. It's dirty because of that word. It's like, what is the intention behind that notion, you know?
We can do like a whole like church George Carlin episode. That would be rad. Seven things you can't say in church.
Sounds like a Michael Jr. stand-up routine.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ. No, not with that intonation. You can't say that. You were doing so well.
That's kind of the point. What is good? What is impure? We throw around these loaded terms, and we don't pursue them beyond a real superficial understanding of, well, here's how they manifest in my opinion.
Yeah.
Here's how they manifest as a voting block. Here's how they manifest as a theological premise. Here's how they manifest in how I show up and worship, scare quotes for those who can't see.
Which is everyone else besides us three.
Yep.
But
so the one listener. Yeah. Dear listener.
I think what's fascinating about this is how often we conflate goodness with being right. Like, whether that's intellectually right or morally right. And like, to be good is to behave well, or behave in line with our societal standards.
Or to know better.
Yeah. Totally.
Right.
And so we define our churches on these terms of like, I'm going to go to I just talked to a guy at a church I visited recently who was like, he'd been at this church for 2 years and said he came there because the church he was at before had some like questionable theology. And like, granted, that's a totally valid reason to switch churches. But at the same time, like, are we just looking for the most right church? Or like, how can we start thinking in terms of like what, as disciples of Jesus, we're called to bring more goodness into the world And how do we find churches that are promoting that? Or how do we cultivate churches that are promoting that?
I'd even go out and throw in, because this has been something that's been on my mind, looking at what happens to people who continually lose hours of sleep, as somebody who's getting like, I don't know, 6-ish maybe on average, and the increased risk for Alzheimer's. And I think a lot of what cultural Christianity has taught me is that it's right beliefs and right values and right systems of thinking. And what happens, because I've been around people who have devolved from Alzheimer's, and it's out of their control. It's not something that they have a whole lot of say over how they think and act and behave after that happens. So they need people to come alongside them and guide and direct and deal with a lot of awful. Where's the room for a church where Alzheimer's can coexist within that space, within that community? People with developmental disabilities, people with, right? There are all these.
Well, for mental health, they just need to believe harder and they'll be fine.
That's how you cure depression, right? More faith. More faith.
50 milligrams more of faith. That'll do it.
Yep. It'll. The Holy Spirit will provide the serotonin that you need, but let's not talk too much about the Holy Spirit, okay?
It's just going down the list from before. This guy.
I love that, because I think like when we recognize the shortcomings of our human brains, it ought to focus us less on that. Like, because I've wondered similarly, like, if I got Alzheimer's and my beliefs changed, am I not saved? Like, or I forgot like core tenets of theology? Like, absolutely not, because it's not in my hands. Like, I belong to Jesus.
Yeah. Well, it's just a weird rationalistic way we have to look at that, because of how we framed all of our theological conversations and discussions through the years, and that this is our priest class. This is who we choose, how we choose our priests. Is, do they believe how we believe? Yes. Then they can follow in our line of priesthood. If they question something, then they are no longer allowed to be within our order, and we have to get rid of them. Mm-hmm. It's the Jedis in Star Wars, where they finally get to the point where they're so political that they're no longer what they were supposed to be.
So we just need an egalitarian Ray to come in who can just do everything magically and fix us.
You guys are referencing the two bad trilogies, and I don't know if that's going to lead us in the right direction.
No. I 100% agree. I'm just being sarcastic. I actually think here's where maybe we deviate the most in terms of some of our thought process. This is where I think liturgy and sacrament and structure also have an important role to play, because I think having those rhythms allow for participation for people who are not able to participate in the way that we value as a society. So I almost wonder too, if even some of the anarchy or anarchic or burn it down approach privileges this ability to think and comprehend and understand in a way that might not draw certain groups of people into the fold.
Which is why I'm willing to be wrong about all of this.
Did you happen to listen to our last episode? Because that was a major point of discussion.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Right on. He's been telling me I'm wrong this whole time. He's playing along.
Joel's probably over dramatizing it. A little bit there.
I have a defeatist attitude. It's fine.
So I will say, Joel and I had an experience last night where Joel lent his car to someone. We had a good conversation on the ride back regarding church structure. And it's like, Joel's comment was, this is the church. And it was funny because I went home to my wife and I'm like, yeah, we were talking about, is church structure really what church is all about? And my wife's immediate response was, no, what Joel did tonight was the church. That was her immediate response. So I think we're way more on the same wavelength than Joel cares to publicly.
Yeah. No, we are. But it's, I mean, that's what I said to Brian as he was walking out my door last night. I was like, this is it. This is like, thank you for the opportunity to be involved in this. This isn't a choice. This isn't something that we choose to do or not. Like, when you have these opportunities and you can freely give something, either Christ's love compels you to do it, or that's a lie.
So
and we can get into safe boundaries and making sure you're not being taken advantage of and all of those things. But just as a general sense, that's the starting point.
Yeah. I mean, like back to the money topic, this is kind of what prompted me to bring up money in our last discussion, which is the like related to the idea of sharing life, which like Joel, you've talked about how blithely and wrongly the church uses that term. I think one of the things that keeps us from sharing life is our idolatrous or at least possessive view of money. And you could throw possessions in there too, your car, for instance. So like, I don't think we really begin to be the church until we can grapple with our possessions as not really being our own. More
and,
to add on that.
And yeah, to be clear, I may edit all of that out about me because I don't like people knowing that I do nice things, because that's like not the point is not to get attention. The point is not to like, maybe I'll blank out names. I don't know. We'll figure out
right
how to move forward.
What your left hand is doing.
Yeah. That's not what this is about. So no, maybe it all stays. Oh, I don't know. We're going to have to figure it out.
I thought you were doing the Dark Knight, like the hero that we need right now, not the hero that we deserve.
It seems more apropos.
Yeah. No, I mean, it just comes into charity porn. And this is something Robert said it to you or Coop, I don't remember. But the reason we know that we view charity as dehumanizing is because we don't want to be on the receiving end.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was really about empowering people to become more human and embracing their humanity and all these things, when it came time for us to be on the receiving end, we would be lining up because we have been giving that power to other people and we want to receive it ourselves when we need it. But instead we are so caught up in no one can know and we can't show people because it's dehumanizing to have to get help from the people in my life because I know what it's like to be the one giving and I don't view these people as equals.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's the cultural self-sufficiency element to it too, where I don't think we always look down on somebody just because we are providing them with help, but we want to be self-sufficient. We want to be able to manage things on our own, which is a whole theological issue too, because we are not redemptively self-sufficient and we still want to be. Like that's the wrestle. And it's an all or nothing proposition too when it comes to possessions. And it's, I am surrendering all that I am, all that I have, all that I could be, all that I will be to the Lord Jesus. It's an oath guy likes to call it the God runs a fiefdom and you are pledging an oath to him where he gives you a certain amount of liberty. But when he calls upon you, that's all of you. It's what he needs from you. And your response better be yes. Otherwise that oath of loyalty meant absolutely nothing.
Dude, drawing on medieval social structure, love it.
Also hit on the part of our conversation you weren't here from. So Coop wasn't here for the start of it where we went over more of like this Venn diagram of money and the priest class and that overlap. So I would be intrigued for you to just come in straight up without knowing what it is and do sort of what do you view that tension of after what you just said about. So last episode we talked about remembering the poor. But then like Judas being like, no, you can't put the perfume on Jesus's feet. Like, what do you view as that tension there? And then priest class being instituted and then money. What would you view as all of that structure?
Complicated. Mm-hmm. It's complicated. I don't think there's some neat cookie cutter answer. Everything's going to have to fit into what is situational. And I think this is part of our Trinitarian conversation too, and our ability to understand and defer to the Spirit and the Spirit's leading, because I think you have situations like Ananias. Where did you guys talk Ananias? Was that a specific?
No, but we did. Like,
okay,
which Ananias? The last episode, you brought up the married one, but I don't know, Brian. Yeah. Are you talking about the old dude?
The man who makes a promise of I'm going to sell my possessions. Sure. And
the other Ananias is one of my spiritual heroes. So.
not this one.
No.
So it's this idea of you're making a full-on pledge. That doesn't mean that God's going to require you to surrender all of that at this particular moment. We could also look at the rich young man, right? He's a man who he fulfilled all of the requirements of the law. He lived up to the law. So he's taking these steps towards entering the kingdom of God. And truly the ultimate thing with the kingdom of God is not possession, not what you own, not what you have, but it is the presence. We are on a way, a path towards being present with God, towards that Eden life where we walk in the garden with him. That is not meant to be mitigated by like a certain group of people saying, all right, we're the gatekeepers, you're here and there. Now, it's supposed to be a communal thing. And so there might be people who are older, wiser, more experienced, or younger and wiser too, for that matter. But
I'm only 31.
Yeah, I'm 38. So,
oh, I'm the oldest here.
Uh-oh.
Let's go.
Uh-oh. But right, I don't think it's a priest class. I think it is a community thing. And it's as a community, we recognize these gifts and talents in people. Right. And these are things that are it's the same thing with money, right? We have wealthy people in our community, people who come into money. We have people who have different gifts and different abilities. Part of stewardship, part of communal stewardship is recognizing those and being able to interact with people in a way that makes sense based on those things. But right, if I don't want somebody who is wise and just because they hold that position, but now going back to the Alzheimer's situation, now has Alzheimer's and their behavior reflects that. I don't want them being the ones making priest-level decisions, right? Their role has to shift. There has to be some fluidity with that. And we have to be able to recognize that. And there's got to be that system in place too of we are all holding one another accountable. It's not you're up here, I'm down here. I need to just defer to you for all things moral, right? Then we get into the whole priest sex abuse issue because of that priest class distinction and problem. Or we get into, like I was talking about earlier in the egalitarian issue, where our pastor comes down real heavy-handed on the congregation of this is what you're going to believe and smarter people than you have said this is how it is, which that doesn't help anybody get nearer or closer to Jesus. That just is the ultimate, look, I'm right, you're wrong, do what I tell you to do.
I do think it is at least connected to that rightness, goodness issue again, a gatekeeping kind of priest class, like you described, at least as far as I can conceive of it, you can't gatekeep goodness. You can gatekeep rightness because there is a like switch to flip there. But goodness is on a spectrum where like the outdoing one another and showing honor kind of thing. Like you just can keep going up if we pursue that more community oriented approach that you're describing. And something that's more spiritual, relational, that's going to be oriented around goodness more. I don't know. I'm just really vibing on this idea. I like it.
It's like rule of law. Rule of law makes sense for really, really large communities with very different sets of beliefs and values.
Hmm.
But this is the whole point of what Christianity is supposed to be, is we're supposed to get out from underneath the rule of law. And you can't do that if you don't know your neighbor, right? And this is the idea of how can I love my neighbor as myself if I don't actually know them? Because loving them as myself is actually seeking what is good for them, not what I think is good for them.
Mm-hmm.
But I need to know you to know what the actual good in that scenario is. I can't do that from this is the right way to do things standpoint. We get too rigid in some of those things and, oh, this is outside. Okay. This is kind of on the border. We'll let it slide for now. Right. And we see that with probably in the biggest area, we probably see that in the church is sexual morality. Gays bad, straight, promiscuous sex is, but we're not going to come down quite as hard because at least they're straight.
Don't have a kid or we'll kind of kick you out.
Well, yeah. Are you a boy or a girl in this situation, right? Because if you're a girl having premarital sex, all right, now we have a whole different issue. You're really, really bad now, even in an egalitarian church, right?
Man, and this is where, like, if we're pursuing a kind of goodness, then really, like, LGBT people are welcome in the church because we are spurring them on to a kind of goodness and we're not litigating how right their lifestyle is.
Well, the problem here is we have made singlehood such a disaster of a personhood that you're not even a person that ranks until you get married, that if we are not going to allow gay people to get married, then we will always keep them as a second-class citizen no matter what. And so that is where our response to homosexuality being, well, you just have to be celibate forever. Even if we don't feel like we're condoning their sin, we're telling them we will always view them as a second class citizen, member of the church, whatever. And so this is where our whole view on marriage has ruined so many other areas. And, you know, that's a little tangent for us, but I think we can't have a good view on homosexuality because we don't have a good view on marriage. And so even the marriage we're protecting now is what's the difference between a Christian marriage and a non-Christian marriage these days? Some of the worst marriages I know are Christians that grew up in the church and all they were taught was be a virgin when you get married and everything else is going to work out. And now that they're married, they don't know how to communicate. They don't know how to solve issues. They don't know how to address anything, whether it's big or small.
And dude, like, just in terms of this idea of marriage being confusing and us being experts at rabbit trails.
Sorry, everyone.
In our church this past Sunday, the message was on a section of 1 Corinthians 7 and talking about marriage and divorce and remarriage and all that. But there are these two paragraphs in which, like, Paul says, if you as believers are married, don't get divorced. And then the following paragraph is, if you as a believer are married to a non-believer and that non-believer leaves, a big freaking deal. They can go. And
that's a direct quote.
That's the Message translation.
And like, I think there's some pragmatic, like, I get that. And Paul is saying, like, I not the Lord in that paragraph, like, fine. But it gives an impression that if you're reading that, like, super strictly, that marriage of believers is in a different class than marriage of non-believers. And I just think that contributes to, how do we even know what marriage is? When Jesus directs us back to the Garden of Eden, as you often do for us, Joel, and all that we really have from the Garden of Eden is like Adam, Eve together. Like, I don't, maybe there's more, but that's all.
And Adam said, wow.
I mean, part of that gets back to what is our telos? What is our aim as a church? And I think a lot of times we default to, we're here to make a good life. And it becomes church as self-help book and self-help guru and self-help guide. And so we fit not into a theology section at Barnes & Noble, but we fit into the social sciences. And I think marriage is one of those things that qualifies with that, right? We've lost touch with, all right, if we're really pursuing what a good godly marriage is supposed to be, it's supposed to be a means for drawing two people nearer to God. There should be some level of sacramentality to it. If it's not, that's a problem. But it also isn't, it doesn't mean that, right, here's what the goal is to get married and to procreate and to have kids, because there are people who that's not their path. That is not their way of drawing nearer to God. So if we don't have multiple paths, if the only path is, here's what it is to be a good person and to be a part of our church. All right, now we have some unhealthy problematic issues going on there in and of themselves, because our aim is off. We're aiming at the wrong thing. We're aiming at a good rather than the good.
Although I do think we're a lot better at making disciples the biological way than the spiritual way sometimes.
Do you want to argue that point?
I have not made a biological disciple.
You guys can argue a joke if you want.
I mean, I know a lot of biological kids who have left the church because the disciples.
Absolutely. I mean, that was one dimension of, I feel like it was a two-sided joke of, we do singer. Really suck at both of those things.
Yes. I think, honestly, this is why I wanted to do this whole adventure anyways, is because of the number of people I know that grew up in the church, got to see what their parents' lives have turned out like after knowing what their parents had been told it would turn out like this whole time, and them going, I really want to follow God. I really need a place to come before God. I believe God is there. I want to know him. But this cannot be it. All I see around me are lies. All I see are brokenness in the way things have turned out for these people and the lives of the pastors that seem to be so clean and squeaky the whole time. And now it's all falling apart. Nothing has turned out as it was supposed to. The fruit is now sprouting and I am seeing that it is all dead. What do I do now? And instead, people in the generation above us all just go, oh, it's apostasy. They're giving up on God. Don't they realize that if they just live the life I had, everything's going to turn out great? It's like your lives are how we know it's not going to turn out great. Your lives are how we know we need to leave and start over and find something new, because this can't be it. And if it is, then why would we want anything to do with God?
It's a moral system again. I think something that would be good to unpack maybe more in a future episode, Joel, is your take on our overemphasis on sin, because I think how we overemphasize sin leads to a lot of that disaffection, dissatisfaction.
Well, yeah, there is no relationship needed when you can just tell if someone's doing something right or wrong. And so this goes back to the looking at people's marriages, I know, where are they cheating on each other? Are they being unfaithful in any way? Are they not cooking dinner? Are they not, you know, are they not fulfilling the roles they're supposed to have according to our setup? No, they're doing all those things. But is their marriage thriving? Is it, like Coop said, is it bringing them closer to God? Absolutely not. It's a huge hindrance because they just have no idea how to address anything at all. And so are they sinning? Boy, who's to say? But are they experiencing that wellspring of life that's supposed to be flowing out of them that Jesus has promised? Oh, certainly not.
Measuring rightness versus goodness.
I think that's maybe like a good, this is where words are really important and how we understand them. And our cultural context for what sin is doing naughty things, but that's not what sin actually has meant historically. That's part of our problem is we have this chronological snobbery, to borrow from C.S. Lewis again. Sorry, my favorite. Right?
I'm not a Lewis fan, but.
You're not a Lewis fan? Beautiful.
Go on. Sorry, we can talk about that later.
Lovely clashes, right? We have this idea that, we just continually progress. And so we're ahead of where those people were. We don't need to look back at them. We don't need to understand their context. We don't need to understand that, oh yeah, they've already had this argument before. And here are the conclusions that they drew from that. And here's why that conversation is actually helpful and pertinent to today, because we are cyclical, not progressive creatures. There might be technological progress, but again, that's another whole tangent of C.S. Lewis and the abolition of man, where we're really enslaving ourselves to these advances that we're making. We're not freeing ourselves in any way. We're not liberating ourselves, but we don't understand that sin is a relational thing. It is a turning from God. It is a going off the path. It is making my own way off in the hedges rather than on that path that God has set and created. Because, right, I hit a hill or there's a weird turn or it got a little bumpy or rocky. So, you know what? This way makes a lot more sense. I'm going to go down that way. And that's human nature. That's our tendency. That's what we're drawn to because Adam and Eve, right? We go back to Genesis. We can get into myth and all that stuff and where that fits. But we can look at ourselves and we can say, I know. That's what I'm trying to footnote that conversation in this conversation.
two listens on our first episode.
There we go. But this whole idea that we're inwardly directed instead of outwardly directed. And that's a problem. And that's what we run into when we run into sin, is we are inwardly directed and we are thinking inwardly of what is good, not realizing that when we are outwardly directed, it might be painful or difficult or more challenging at times, but it actually is going to lead to what is good and what is flourishing. And sometimes that requires some pruning. To me, that's more in line with what sin is than the idea of, oh, you did something naughty, or you're doing everything right on the outside, so you're squeaky clean and good. That's a crock of shit.
Yeah. And so what this opens up for me, maybe we need to wrap up this episode, because I feel like some things you said there were like, oh, but let's get into this box of Charles Taylor and the buffered versus porous self. And that would be really fun. That might be more than trying to tackle right here.
Can we talk about James Taylor instead and just dream of going to Mexico or Carolina in my mind?
I'd rather be on a country road than a secular age.
Okay. Well,
well played.
Here's what I want to get into for next episode. I don't know who's going to be involved with it, but I kind of want to get into the kingdom of God going next. I feel like we've alluded to it. Kingdom of heaven, call it whatever you want. We've alluded to it. I think we have a lot of good tangent rabbit trails to get into here from what we just talked about. So if we can pin these.
Do you want my annotated copy of City of God?
No, I don't. Hoop likes Augustine, reading back Augustine.
Into the podcast for the next several episodes.
And here's another footnote with a highlight. Thanks, Brian. Yeah. So let's stop here. Let's continue forward. I don't know how much of money and the priest class we actually got into, but I feel all of these issues. Here's the deal.
This podcast isn't called On Topic.
Right. This podcast is called Rabbit Trails and Tangents. So we are going to start and Robert, I'm running this past you on air here. What we're going to start doing is release an episode of Rabbit Trails and then recordings that Brian and I've already done called Tangents. Going to pivot every other week for now. And then, release one episode of one episode of the other and just kind of keep going and see when we catch up and can all end up on the same page for everything.
Right on.
Okay. Thanks to our listener. Appreciate the...
Hi, Mom.
Mom, if you've made it this far in the episode, I'm sorry. This is the son you raised. I don't know what went wrong, but here we are. Okay. Take it easy, everyone. Thanks for playing along, and we'll catch you soon.
Sayonara.
Sayonara.